John Fisher, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, thanks, Jeff. And so, I always call you Jeff. I know your name is really Jeffrey.
That's okay, but first name only. I'm fine with Jeff.
Oh, good.
And considering we've known each other for more than 30 years, I think this is okay.
Okay, good, good.
John and I, truth to tell, used to be neighbors in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and both ended up working at TV stations, ultimately in the same chain in Oregon. So always good to have you back here. What have you been doing since you stopped forecasting on a regular basis?
Well, good, but as you mentioned, once you've got weather in your blood, which I did as a young kid, you kind of keep watching it. And the advent of the computer, it used to be that if you wanted to see what the computer models were doing or, get more of a forecast than what you could get on the radio or over the telephone, you had to be professional. But now I can go on the computer and see exactly the same things that I used to look at, as a paid person, decades ago. And, of course, things have gotten better. The computer models are just amazing. So in a certain way, I almost look at the weather more now than I used to because it's so easy.
I don't know how much you've gotten into technology. I mean, you mentioned going onto computers, but I don't know if you're a smartphone guy and carry it around and have multiple apps for looking things up.
I don't yet. And I'll be honest, sometimes it's nice. I'll take a trip somewhere. I was hiking for a couple of weeks this summer, and there was no connection to the weather. And it was kind of nice just to have it come at you with no preconceived notion of what it was supposed to be and all that stuff, to just let nature take its course, because it can be annoying almost to be so in tune with what's going to happen and what's supposed to happen. But if I'm home, it's hard not to look at the 10-day forecast and see if it's going to snow or rain or whatever.
The concept of a 10-day forecast is something that seems pretty alien to us. I remember when we got up to 5-day forecasts in TV, thinking, boy, we're really getting out on a ledge here. But you mentioned with the quality of information now, are the 10-day forecasts reasonably reliable?
Well, certain kinds of weather patterns. I don't know I know you're kind of a weather buff, too. But if you'll notice, if we're going to have a cold wave where it's going to get really, really down below average, say 5 or 10 degrees or something, those things are forecast pretty well 8 and even 10 days in advance. But an individual storm or something of that sort, or a wet period or a dry period, 10 days is really kind of pushing it. So a certain really big event, I'm shocked at how well the computers can look at those things way out. But as I mentioned, I've been watching the weather here. In the fall, I'm ready to go skiing, as a lot of people are, and so I'm watching to see when it's going to snow. And a week ago, it looked like it was going to snow a whole bunch starting today, and then 5 days ago, it looked like it would snow some starting the early part of this week, and now it looks like it'll snow starting at the end of this week. So things change, and you can't pin all your hopes on one 10-day forecast. You've got to watch the progression and the way it changes. So the 10-day is a lot better than it used to be, but it's not perfect by any means.
John Fisher, you had been a ski patroller. Is that still the case up at Willamette Pass?
Yep. I think this is my 23rd year. But as you're well aware, Mount Ashland got a never start last year. Willamette Pass, where I work, got a real slow start. And it's another one of those slow years. One of the places you can kind of watch what's been happening with the snow, I noticed up at Crater Lake, they're a little over average for their rainfall, about 110%. But snowfall is about half of average. And the amount on the ground is about a half of average. And if you're a skier or you have interest in summer water, it's kind of a disturbing, terrible trend to see. The snowpack is less than it used to be. The snow elevation, the snow level is higher than it used to be. So this, fall and early winter, we've had rain. We've had, pretty typical rain amounts, but it's been warmer. So there's not much snow in the mountains yet. And, they should have had 100 inches at Crater Lake already this time of the year as far as what's fallen. They've had less than 50. So, averages made up of lots and lots of years. But, I'm still a ski patroller, and I'm still really annoyed that I'm not skiing.
John Fisher's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a meteorologist always, former on-the-air meteorologist for KEZI in Eugene. So a lot of folks in the Eugene-Springfield area remember the name and the voice. Join us on the Exchange with your weather comments, questions, things you'd like to know about the weather, particularly as we get into the season where it's getting really interesting. Join us at 800-838-3760 around the region. 800-838-3760. Emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. So what are the factors that would lead to this sort of thing? Because I was looking at some precipitation figures. The Rogue Valley, for example, is above normal in precipitation. both, I think, for water year and for calendar year. So there's certainly enough precipitation falling, but it's not falling cold enough to be snow. And I just checked Mount Ashland a couple minutes ago. It looks like 2 inches of rain, 2 inches of snow on the ground, and that's probably getting rained on today.
Right, and Mount Ashland typically is hoping to be open by Christmas. Mount Bachelor is hoping to be open by Thanksgiving. And, you know, Christmas is still a long ways away, and there's good potential to get back into this. But, you know, there's two things that are obviously affecting the change in snow levels, and one of them is global warming. If it's warmer, the snow level goes up. That's a pretty simple one. But there's a lot of variability in the climate. If you go back into the 30s, we had a period where we didn't have very much snow, and precip was below average, and temperatures were above average. So there's multiple variabilities thrown into this up-and-down average curve. Hopefully we'll get a few more of the cooler, wetter ones. 5 years ago, we had 9 feet of snow on the ground up by a cabin that I have near Odell Lake. Last year, I don't think there was ever more than 9 inches. So you can't put all that in a climate change. A lot of this is just variability that's, you know, pretty typical.
The variability sometimes seems to be rather sudden, though, in the sense that you'll have what seems like a quote-unquote normal trend or a trend that matches the long-time averages going on for a couple of months, and then all of a sudden, poof, it'll stop. And then I find this particularly from living in the Rogue Valley, where it seems like the winter's going along fairly normally until early February. You get what I think meteorologists refer to as a midwinter thaw. But then in some cases, it just never comes back, and it just stays clear from then on.
Right. I mean, it's a really, really, really complex system, the way the weather works around the globe and in any individual location. And then you throw the mountains in to tweak things. And so to try to pin down 1 week changes or that 2 week dry spell in the middle of February, many years ago when we first started getting computers to be part of the weather forecast picture, there was a vision that we were going to be able to go, oh, well, if we have enough computer data and a powerful enough computer, I'll be able to tell you what it's going to be like in 2027 at noon in downtown Ashland. Well, there's a theory that's not a theory anymore. It's pretty clear, called chaos. And you can have the same initial condition and have numerous different outcomes. And chaos theory pretty much takes the 10-day forecast and probably puts it as close to the upper limit of what we'll do for weather, but as far as more general trends, like this is going to be an El Nino winter. That means it'll be warmer and drier for most of the Northwest. Medford Ashland is kind of on the cusp. It'll be cold, wetter and warmer in California, and you guys have to decide, do you live in California really, or do you live in Oregon really? And I'm kind of being silly there, but
right.
As far as the weather goes, you're in an El Nino that tends to be farther north California, you're in a wetter period during an El Nino. And in one of the El Ninos, and often by the second half of the winter, it'll shift farther south towards Los Angeles. In that kind of a period, you're in the drier than average category. So you don't get the same, you're real well-defined Seattle, El Nino, dry and warm.
So
El Nino, wet and warm. But you guys are kind of in between.
Right, and in fact, I noticed just looking at, I had a chance to glance at the SF Gate, the newspaper site for San Francisco, and there's a big storm apparently coming in there on Wednesday, in which they think there will be flooding. How does a forecaster know how much moisture a storm is likely to bring with it?
Oh, I mean, it's amazing. All the sensors that are out over the Pacific give you what's called precipitable water that you can examine through satellite imagery now, a column of the atmosphere, and see how much rain could fall out of it were it all to come out. And then with lift and the cooling that happens when the air comes down from the north, you can determine how much of it will fall out. This is a really cool-looking storm that's coming. I noticed that the folks out of Medford Weather Service office are thinking, this is the kind of storm that will happen, and this is for southern Oregon especially, every 3 to 5 years. So a lot of wind and a lot of rain. There's some snow as you get up higher, but the computer models are just uncanny in their ability to take all the information, which is out there over the Pacific, and turn it into a weather forecast from the stream air that's moving over us. So it looks like a big, interesting storm. And California is really, they haven't turned the corner by any means to get a couple of rainstorms. But this makes a big difference. We'll watch Shasta Lake change where it is pretty quickly. So it's the data is out there. It's just amazing that the computers can put it all together and come up with, you know, pretty good forecast. We're talking about a storm in California on Thursday and Friday. It's going to be a big storm. It's only Monday.
And we know this already. John Fisher is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, meteorologist, a long time at KEZI in Eugene, since retired, and is now a master gardener and doing some gardening segments for our sister station KLCC in Eugene. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 with weather questions. We know you have them. 800-838-3760. Send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. When you look, though, at the sensors you were just talking about out in the Pacific, where you can learn a lot about what's coming in the atmosphere, the fact is it's still sort of like bread dough. You have to lay it over the surface of the earth, and it lays out unevenly. So how much does topography play a factor in how weather is distributed and what it turns into?
Oh, I mean, topography is huge, especially in places where you have topography. When we lived in Wisconsin, the difference between a storm in Milwaukee, 1 inch of rain, and a storm in Green Bay, 0.97, wasn't much because there was no lifting of mountains. But this next storm that comes in, it'll probably rain. Oh, there's places in the northern California coast that'll get 12, 15 inches. And Redding will maybe get 2 or 2.5. But the lift that occurs when air goes up, it cools off. All of our physics majors remember PV equals NRT, pressure times volume. So as the pressure goes down, the temperature goes down. When the temperature goes down in a parcel of air, it can't hold as much water. So it falls out. So as it goes over the mountains, it gets colder, and the rain is much more intense. So topography is just huge in the West. There's great maps on the Oregon Climate Service website that show how much it rains in real detail across Oregon, and it takes topography into account because it's mostly sensor, you know, actual rain gauge derived, but it makes some extrapolations between places, and northern Oregon coast gets 140 inches a year. In desert, the Alvord Desert gets 5 inches a year. You know, it's a lot of variation, and it's all topography driven.
So, if the air can't hold the water as it gets colder, does a swifter rise indicate a heavier rainfall or just a faster one?
Oh, I mean, generally, absolutely, the more quickly it's rising since it can't hold it. What will also happen, though, is if you're trying to push things over the mountains fast enough, it just literally can't all come out. And so a strong westerly wind will deliver more rain to Redding and to Ashland and to Medford than a more gentle westerly wind, which will squeeze it all out as it comes up over the coast range. So definitely wind speed and lift speed makes a difference, but it's not. You might think that if air is going up over the coast range, it won't rain even a drop in Medford ever. And clearly that's not the case. So even though it's gone over the mountains, the coast range, then it goes over the Cascades, Klamath Falls still gets rain from the same storm coming out of the west that we do. But absolutely, the faster the uplift, the heavier the rain. And that's why great big thunderstorms that'll have a vertical velocity of as much as 100 miles an hour produce these incredible rainfalls.
All right. That was exactly where that question was going. Excuse me. Let's go to Peter in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with meteorologist John Fisher.
Good morning. I have a question for John about I heard a thing on, KMED the other day that basically the guy who was well-credentialed for sure was saying the idea that our climate is warming is a crock, and I would just be curious to hear what your guest has to say about this whole debate.
All right, thanks for that, Peter. Appreciate it.
Well, hey, I wouldn't say it's a debate. You know, it's clearly warmer than it was. I believe they're saying now 2014 is on track to be the warmest year we've ever had. I'll grant you that these differences are a degree and a half or 2 degrees, even at the very peak, and I think this year is 1.5, don't quote me. So they're not the kind of things that you detect and go, wow, it seems really hotter today. But I don't see that there's any debate or there shouldn't be a debate. There should just be a question of exactly what the measurement is. It's definitely getting warmer, and you can't put CO2 in the atmosphere or in any system and not expect it to reabsorb the long-wave radiation and put it back out. So it's just kind of a physics experiment. It's happening.
All right, here's another question from Ann and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. I go horseback riding. I've been doing this twice a week for the last 9 years, and I'm usually out at the stable between 10 and 1 on those days. And what I've noticed is there's only a couple of times during the winter, usually, when I have to stay in the indoor arena rather than going out on the trail or ride that I want to go. And so I was wondering, has there ever been any studies about what time of day rain falls here in the Willamette Valley? Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that, Ann. Appreciate it.
More rain tends to fall in the afternoon because there is some heating from the ground. In the Willamette Valley, the amount of heating we get in December and January from the sun is pretty trivial, but it's not uncommon at all to have showers increase once the sun warms the ground because it provides more lift with thermal rise. So a little the afternoon, 10 to 1, at 2 o'clock, you're more likely to get rain than you are at 9 o'clock.
All right, and I hear this happening in other places, too. My wife, Joy, used to live in Tampa. She swore at 2 o'clock every afternoon, and it rained really hard for about 15 minutes.
Yes, and those kind of places. I was hiking in Colorado a few years ago, and everybody else was coming back at about noon, and my wife and I, being from Oregon, were going out at noon. Well, it didn't take very many days to realize that 2:15 every day, these massive thunderstorms pop up, and that's why all the locals were coming back already.
All right, so it is regular. Let's. John Fisher is a meteorologist, formerly with KEZI and Eugene, and our guest on the exchange. We've got a couple minutes left if you'd like to ask some questions, make some comments about weather conditions, atmospheric conditions, 800-838-3760 around the region, 800-838-3760. Email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Peter in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, hi there. Yeah, I had heard that... rain actually falls from electrostatic forces, and it actually pulls it faster than it falls from gravity normally. I wonder, if, is that true?
Electrostatic as in static electricity, that sort of thing?
As like a positive negative of like static electricity from the ground and from the clouds.
No, rain falls pretty much gravity driven. The electrostatic piece of it, when hail forms, up high, it breaks and then charge is separated, and that's what causes thunder and lightning. Well, it causes lightning, which of course causes thunder. So now, if rain pretty much falls at the speed that gravity is going to push on it. The other thing that's kind of interesting about the rain that falls here is even in the summer, 90% of it, with the exception of thunderstorm rain, started as a snowflake and melted at some point on the way down. So it's often snowing at 10,000 feet. Even if there's no snow hitting anything, because there's no mountain at 10,000 feet, and then it melts on the way down. But gravity works on rain pretty much the same way.
And you anticipated the next question, which is whether most precipitation falls as snow, and the answer is yes, but it doesn't stay snow for long.
No.
I have a question about how localized weather can get, because honest to goodness, I have noticed in a recent winter, it was snowing in Ashland. The next place on the freeway, Talent, where I live, it was raining. And then the next place up the freeway toward Medford, Phoenix, it was snowing. So there was just this little island of rain in the middle of snow. And I mean, how micro can a microclimate get?
Oh, it can be amazing. I'm coming down from Willamette Pass a year or two ago, and it's raining in Pleasant Hill. You may not know this area, but 2 miles later, just 2 miles down a hill, there's 5 inches of snow on the ground. So the fact that cold air is denser, and this kind of refers to the question you have, cold air is denser, so it'll sit in the bottoms of the valleys, and that's why we get the cold fog during the winter time. But if you have sub-freezing air and then a storm comes in, places where it mixes a little more, the snow will have a chance to melt before it comes through the cold air and hits the ground, whereas if it's a slightly deeper mound of cold air, we just had some freezing rain up here and it was a very similar situation. If that cold air is a little deeper, then the snow or the rain won't have a chance to melt on the way through. So we get way more microclimates here than they do in the Midwest. And again, it's all about the topography.
All right. Here's another question from Skyler in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Fisher.
Hi, I just kind of want to build on that same question. Just looking for information on really microclimate. I do a lot of camping, and I notice that sometimes on one side of the mountain, the air is warmer than on the other side of the mountain, and different times of day, the air is blowing up the hill, and sometimes it's blowing down the hill. You know, if you're camping by a lake, it's obviously different than if you're camping on the tops of the mountain. Any direction on where I could get information on really small microclimate behaviors?
Jeff, I think his name is Jeff Renner. He's out of King TV, and he wrote a book called Mountain Weather for the Pacific Northwest, and it does a really nice job of explaining some of the obvious things. But in the morning, the sun shining on the east slope creates lift. In the nighttime, the cooling effect of radiational cooling, where the ground gets colder than the air, then cools the ground and it creates downslope winds. So, as you've observed, the best way to really get the microclimate information is to be in the place and go there. And after about the fifth time of finding that unusual wind pattern in this one valley, you start to realize, well, it's not unusual, it's the microclimate of this valley. So, in the really convoluted terrain we have here, to get a book or any even online source that would explain each little valley and lake's microclimate would be pretty unusual. But the kind of microclimates that occur in the mountains are pretty well defined. And again, Jeff Renner's book is a good place. And I hate to say it, go click on Google for microclimates and you'll get a whole bunch of information about it too.
All right, let's go to a final question. Nicole in Ashland, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with meteorologist John Fisher.
Good morning, Jeffrey and John. I just have, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I was wondering if you have any idea about this winter in this area, how it's going to transpire.
Yes, so this winter being an El Nino winter, pretty well defined, pretty well established, it'll be wetter and warmer than average for the Rogue Valley. So I'd expect 120% of average rainfall, but less than average snowfall as you get up high. On Ashland, I think we'll do okay, a.k.a. open. But, yep, looks a little warmer this year and definitely a little wetter.
All right, and we'll have you on in the future sometime and talk about how that's affecting your master gardening work, because I imagine you're seeing some differences in there as well. But we are out of time for this segment. John Fisher, always a pleasure to talk to you. Best of luck.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Take care. John Fisher's a meteorologist, formerly with KEZI in Eugene, and obviously, once a meteorologist, always a meteorologist. You keep your interest in the weather.